Managing Violence Podcast, episode 68. Join me as I interview and have conversation with Todd Karpela, former Finnish national police officer, conflict resolution expert, and one of Europe's leading minds on threat assessment. You don't want to miss this episode. If you have any interest in conflict resolution or verbal de-escalation, Toddy has some amazing insights. You're going to enjoy it. Welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast. Welcome, everybody, to the Managing Violence Podcast. I am joined today by Toddy Karpela, one of Europe's leading minds in threat assessment, an amazing mind when it comes to verbal de-escalation and conflict resolution. Before we jump straight to the interview with Toddy, I just want to say thank you to all the members that contributed on Patreon. In October, we donated all of our Patreon contributions to the Ensign Inouye Foundation. Go back and check out the interview we did with Ensign if you want to know more about the work he's doing. But that has funded humanitarian efforts in the north of Japan and help support our warrior brother Ensign Inouye. So thank you very much for everyone who contributed to that. It was very humbling to be able to do that again. Guys, the new merch has arrived. Check it out. I'm still getting used to where the logo is. Check it out on the violencepod.com website. We have some pretty cool stuff there. These are really high quality shirts. I'm very impressed. They're fun. They're facilitated by Teespring. So you place your order through there. It's all perfectly safe and secure. They manufacture it. They ship it to your door. Fulfillment comes from either US or Europe. So no matter where you are in the world, you can get it relatively promptly. So make sure you check that out. But without further ado, I want to throw straight to this amazing interview, a very fun conversation I had with Mr. Toddy Karpela. At the Managing Violence Podcast, we're all about the protector. Whether you are sworn to protect and serve, or just to protect what's most precious to you. Whether your mission is to protect others, or just get home safely. If you are the one that stands between the wolves and the sheep, we are with you. We are for you. We are here to help you prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from violence in all its forms. Managing Violence Podcast. For the protectors. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Toddy Karpela, all the way from Finland, our first mainland European guest. And what a tremendous guest he is. Toddy has a 20-year career in the Finnish National Police, where he was responsible for analyzing and responding to threats on law enforcement and judiciary officials. He also spent most of his career teaching in the National Police University on conflict resolution and verbal de-escalation strategies. He's also one of Europe's leaders in threat assessment, working throughout Europe and Asia in his private business now. Toddy and I were both speakers at the recent Protective Security and Government Conference and hit it off. And I thought, this is a man we need to have on the Managing Violence Podcast. So thank you for joining us, Toddy Karpela.
Thanks, Joe. I'm honored and privileged to have this chat with you.
Look, I'm so grateful to have you on because you know, we've had a lot of people from the US, a lot of people from the UK. It's nice to cross over the channel. So, Toddy, tell us a little bit about your career. How did you get started? What led you into law enforcement? And just give a bit of a snapshot of the things you did in the police.
Okay. So I've... My history is very, very security oriented. So when I was in high school and when I was in college, I was trying to make some extra money by working as a bouncer and as a security guard. In Finland, the military service is mandatory. So of course I applied and got into the military police. So I was there doing my service at the military police academy as an instructor on defensive tactics and close quarter battle. So I've done martial arts since I was a young kid. At the age of 20, I applied to get into the police academy, the National Academy, and got in. So I've ever since I've been able to do any type of work, it's always been security and combining that with martial arts. We had an interesting discussion before this podcast, actually, with you, Joe, and my history comes from a broken home. My childhood was not the most pleasant one, with lots of domestic violence and physical and psychological abuse. Not too much towards me, but between my parents. So I was drawn into the world of violence as kind of looking at explanations on why people do things, what they do. And I was very fortunate. I got into the K-9 unit almost as soon as I started in the police. And K-9 unit, as you know, are usually the first ones, were the stupid guys who go in through the door first. And I kept a diary on all the call outs that were high risk or that were violent calls, on what type of information did we get, how did we prepare for the call, what was the first reaction when we encountered these individuals, how did they respond to us, and was there any other way we could have managed these cases? Because I really wanted to get into whatever happened, what was the reason for it. And at the same time, I was teaching defensive tactics at the police academy and later on at the police university. So it's been a path that I'm still very eager to study, to understand what makes people tick, and what are the things that we could do to prevent the actual physical violence. I'm quite big. I'm 2 meters and 125 kilos, and I've done martial arts years, and now I've found my true calling, and it's rugby. But for me, it has never been a challenge to be in a physical confrontation. I think it's just enough discipline training and fitness training and learning the techniques. For me, it's always been more challenging on influencing the decision-making process and meeting people who are very, very aggressive or afraid or whatever the reason is to have them calm down. That's the ultimate test for me.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to pull apart, and I think that's what we're going to focus on for this conversation is some of the conflict resolution strategies that you taught and the things that you've learned in on the front lines that have worked for you. I know just some of our communication we've had before setting this interview up that Dr. George Thompson of Verbal Judo fame was an influence on you. So when you first started teaching verbal de-escalation, was it based on that verbal judo information, or was it based on something else?
No. The first book that I came across was actually by, I believe he's a Canadian police officer, Roland Ouellette, and the book was Management of Aggressive Behavior. And I was drawn into it because it was a book written by a police officer to police. And I believe he mentions verbal judo in his book. So I next book I picked up was Verbal Judo. But in the beginning, I was more drawn into the MOAB, the Management of Aggressive Behavior system. But I've met George Thompson a number of times when he was still alive. I was certified to be their trainer in the Northern Europe region and stuff. And I still believe that there's a lot of good things within verbal judo as a foundation to almost any professional who has to deal with challenging communication.
So let's break down your approach. Obviously, we start off with MOAB. We've got verbal judo, and then obviously, I mean, you're now without it's not an exaggeration to say you're one of Europe's leading minds when it comes to threat assessment and violence. So what is your approach now? If you were to summarize the key things that people need to know to be able to de-escalate aggressive or escalated behavior?
Okay, well, that's a million-dollar question.
Yeah.
I think based on my 30 plus years working with violent offenders and people who are very, very emotional, I think the foundation has to start with your own professional, your ego, your self-image, and the concept of how do you see yourself as a professional? What is your goal? Because I think if you haven't figured that one out, and you approach people who are venting out their emotions at you or blaming you for whatever happens, or they're afraid of you, if you don't know who you are and what you represent, I find it very difficult to see that you would be successful in the de-escalation. So everything starts from your personal mindset, how you approach mm-hmm. things.
It's actually Richard Dimitri was the one who first told me that self-defense begins with self, you know, and it really does. I mean, if you have to have that confidence in yourself so that you won't buy into the game, I guess, and you won't be triggered, especially if you're in any sort of authority role, whether it's bouncing in nightclub or policing or military or anywhere else. There's a game that has to be played, you know, where they'll try to trigger you or they'll try to get you to act unprofessionally. And even if they're not trying, if you don't have enough self-awareness about how you act when you're threatened or challenged or, you know, certain insults, then you'll overreact and blow the situation up anyway.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that you mentioned it as a game, because whenever I teach people conflict resolution and verbal de-escalation, I refer to it as a game. And I want to win the game. But winning the game doesn't mean that I win the opponent or I don't want the opponent to lose, which is pretty much the same thing. For me, winning the game is reaching my goal in a way that the person that I'm dealing with feels that they were respected, they were listened to, their values and opinions were valued. And when they calm down, that's for me winning the game. And it's sort of a psychological mechanism as well, thinking it as a, if I'm dealing with you as a professional, I'm not talking about when I talk to my teenage daughter or my teenage son, but as a professional, I think it is important to understand that it is a sort of a game and you need to be the master of the game.
It's something I came across when I started teaching verbal de-escalation or conflict communication courses with young men, like teenagers, was that it was very hard to get them to buy into this idea that you can actually win a fight without fighting, right? Or that they'd even want to, because it's so much of fighting at that age is about hierarchy and being the big dog. And, you know, it's like they want to escalate. They want it to get physical because that's the whole point. So the idea of like trying to sell them on verbal judo was like, well, why would I? You know, they don't have to do paperwork. They don't really care if it escalates. But if you can tell them, like, you're winning a game here. Like, you're actually winning a battle. And you're so far ahead that the other party doesn't even know they're in a fight yet. But you're already winning the fight. And they don't even know they're in it yet.
Oh, absolutely. There's one of the stories that I used to usually tell. It's by Miyamoto Musashi, who was the samurai who developed the style of two swords. And according to the story, he also developed a fighting style called the fighting without swords. And according to the legend, he was crossing a bay on a boat when a young samurai saw Musashi and said, "I know who you are, and according to samurai rules, you have to fight me." And Musashi said, "Well, okay, I'll do whatever you want." And then they take a small boat from the ferry and go into a sandy small island, and the young samurai jumps off the boat first, and Musashi starts to row back into the ship, and the young samurai says, "Hey, what are you doing? I mean, we were supposed to fight." And he yells back and said, "Well, I won because this is the style of no swords."
Yeah, you know what? I'm actually listening to the audiobook of Musashi the novel at the moment. So, so many good stories from that. But let's dive back into your approach there. One of the things that I find as key to be able to de-escalate anyone is empathy and really having empathy for the situation the person's in. Do you find that as well?
Yes. I've been doing conflict resolution programs on every single continent. And whenever we do a full day program, one of the questions I ask the participants is, let's change roles. You are now frustrated. You are not happy with the system, social services, the hospital or the travel agency, whatever the case is, but you are very, very frustrated at the moment. What are the three qualities or characteristics you would like to see in a person that has to deal with you, who's representing the organization? And I ask the same question in every single continent, and there's three qualities that every single culture comes up with. And it's empathy, listening skills, and the capability to stay calm. These three, it doesn't matter which culture I'm in, you have to show empathy, you have to be a good listener, and you have to be calm in the situation. Mm-hmm. I think it's fascinating, because no matter which culture you're talking about, these three come up.
Mm. And I think there's a line that needs to be drawn there between empathy and actual empathy, because I think fake empathy is even worse than no empathy. Like when someone's just trying to say the right words and you know they're just going through the script.
Well, I slightly disagree with you, because almost every time that I talk about empathy, we have individuals who come up to me and say, I'm not a very empathetic person, so how do I use empathy? And my counter argument is that if it's not coming from the heart, it's still important that we at least try to use some words that we relate in a cultural context, that we relate to the empathy. I agree with you on the part that if you're just saying those words because you really don't care, it's like, well, I can only imagine how you feel. Mm. You're going to get punched. It's not
the delivery is important.
exactly. But I would still recommend people to at least try to use a few phrases. I can only imagine how this must feel for you, or feel to you, or if I would be in your shoes, I would probably be quite unhappy as well. Because it's important that the person that you're trying to calm down feels that their emotional reaction has been noted.
Mm-hmm. How do you encourage people to listen better? I mean, everyone thinks they listen, but we know that very few people are very good at listening.
Well, I spent 10 years as a negotiator in our national SWAT team. And what is being taught in Finland is every single police unit needs to have the basic skill set to take control over an incident and kind of keep it as possible for 30 minutes so that we get at least one negotiator responding to the scene. And some of the police officers were, and they still are, very focused on them telling what needs to be done. And that's typical for law enforcement. And I said, well, if we need to calm people down, how on earth can you calm people down if you don't know what's getting them so angry? So listening is the way to get information that you can use later on. Oh, I'm so angry with my ex-wife, or the IRS, or my landlord is doing this and that, whatever the case might be. But you need to keep an open mind and listen, because the more you listen, the more tools you have in using that information in calming people down.
Mm, mm. And I think, as you said, like using it as a form of almost intel gathering, you know, it's intelligence. Like you need to know. Yep. You know, Chris Voss talks about the black swan, you know, trying to find that one piece of information that changes everything. It's critical. I mean, you until you understand the situation, if your goal is actually de-escalation, and I think that's probably a good point to raise, like if your goal is actually de-escalation and you're not just going through the motions until you can justify an escalation, or if you're just trying to buy time, or and one thing I say a lot is that with verbal communication or conflict communication, you don't always have to be trying to de-escalate. There's different roles of communication. You can de-escalate, you can give directives, you can overwhelm. But as long as you're clear of what your goal is, that's fine. But I think if you're trying to de-escalate, then you have to listen. In fact, if you're doing more listening than talk, more talking than listening, you're definitely doing it wrong.
I absolutely agree. And then very often, when I teach these skills, I'll have a champagne bottle. Well, not actually a champagne bottle, but a sparkling water bottle, and I shake it. And then on the bottom of the bottle, that's the facts, that's the hardcore data, that's rules, regulations, laws, and policies. That's something that you as a professional can later on explain. But as soon as you pop the bottle open, the pressure needs to come out. And that's the part where you listen. Because if there's still bubbles coming out from the bottle, it's very difficult for you to add anything into the bottle. So very often de-escalation, it's not a dialogue, it's a monologue.
Yeah.
The other side needs to talk, and that your role is to listen.
Yeah. And if you try to do too much talking, you're going to end up escalating anyway, because as you said, everyone wants to be heard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
What sort of industries are you finding there's need? I mean, obviously, you started off doing this for policing and law enforcement, first responders. I know that you're quite in demand now professionally as well, doing this across a variety of sectors. Where are you finding the biggest needs?
I think that any professional who needs to communicate with other people. So really, it's really difficult to say where's the biggest need. Because, I mean, if you look at the police or social services or emergency room in the hospital, these people already, they're quite experienced in dealing with highly emotional individuals. But if I really need to pinpoint a specific field, I would say government organizations that don't necessarily do conflict resolution on a daily basis, but they are still making major decisions that impact people's lives. Mm. I would say that probably would be where the biggest need is. But if you're talking about financial impact, then any organization that has to deal with complaints or unhappy customers or patients or students, whatever.
Yeah, and I think there's an impact factor now where in the current age, any dissatisfaction with service can become a very big deal. It used to be you'd have one unhappy customer and whoever else was there when they witnessed the outburst. And as long as it didn't get physical, that was the end of it. Now it's recorded and shared and you've got $500,000 PR issue.
Yeah, that's either people record the call or then they record you doing or saying very unhealthy things. So there's a number of examples where it just starts to have a life of its own. And on a number of cases, when the instance that have led the organization to use our services, it's like, oh, you really didn't say that. That's whatever made you say things like that. And yeah, common sense is not too common.
Especially when people get emotional, right? I mean, there's always two parties involved. There's one party who might be crossing a line in terms of their professionalism and or in terms of how they're supposed to be behaving themselves. But if the other party gets triggered and they're emotionally involved as well, then all bets are off.
Yeah, one of the sayings that I teach to people is by Mark Twain: when you're having an argument with an idiot, make sure he is not doing the same thing.
I love that one.
And it's just unreal how quickly people are kind of pulled into the conflict, and they lose their professionalism, and they forget their objective in the situation. And then you got two individuals arguing, and nobody's there actually representing the organization as it should be represented.
How did you find teaching, especially, I guess, younger or less experienced police officers this when they sort of, I mean, I think it's the same globally. A certain percentage of young police officers are going to join with this sense of authority, and they've got a badge and they've got a uniform and they're there to uphold the law, and then telling them to stop and actually have empathy for the bad guys. How did that go?
That's very demanding. Because I was the same. Absolutely. I think you need to have at least few years in any type of work where you have to deal with people who are not behaving nicely. Psychiatric nurse or a bouncer or a waiter or whatever the role, or as a young police officer, and only then kind of understand what needs to be done. Because I was absolutely the same kind of individual. And I didn't see any wrong with it, because as said, my image of what my role as a police officer is was not correct. So it's very challenging. After a couple of years on the job, I started to look at three of my sergeants who were amazing. And I was fuming in a call with certain individuals, and they never allowed that individual to impact their decision-making process or their behavior. And what was even more amazing was that after a call, we'd go to the next call, and there was absolutely no burden from the previous call. They would be just as calm and just as pleasant as they were in the beginning of the previous call. And if I guess my first realization was that it gets very, very tiresome if you get angry to every individual who's trying to get you angry.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be a long shift and a very, very long week.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Actually, there's a quote from Hicks and Gracie, obviously the legendary martial artist, that I took from the jiu-jitsu realm, and I applied it when I started looking at, you know, this whole idea of behavioral management. And he said that a trained jiu-jitsu man looks at the biggest guy in the bar and he doesn't go, how scary. He looks at the biggest man in the bar and goes, how interesting. Like it's a problem-solving strategy, right?
Yeah.
And I really like that. And I look at that now in terms of really troubling behavior and go, interesting. Like, what are the levers we have to press here to make this work?
Exactly. And when I was still with the police, Helsinki doesn't have full-time negotiators. So we would have, patrol and detectives and what have you. But every single time that I would meet an individual who was afraid or who was delusional or who was frustrated, whatever the reason was why we were being called there, that's spot on my thoughts exactly. I would say, wow, that's really interesting. What's going on here? Instead of getting perhaps frustrated myself or angry because people don't calm down when I tell them to calm down.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I think the more experience you get when you see one you haven't seen before, that's when it really is interesting.
Yeah.
Strange the things that amuse you after a while.
Right.
So I'm really interested more to expand more upon your strategies. I mean, the listening is crucial. The empathy is crucial. Where do we go from there to be able to guide this conversation towards a resolution?
Well, one of the things that is creating yet an additional challenge is I often talk about the role of bias. And it's not just the bias of the person that you're trying to calm down, but it's your own biases as well. And we spend a lot of time thinking about, and this kind of gets back to the professionalism as well, but in martial arts, you have mushin, the empty mind or no mind. How do you develop that? And then how do you tackle the bias of the person that you have to deal with, and I think there once you have your professionalism and your self-image sorted out, And you understand that it's a game that as a professional you have to do. And then we take the role of bias into the situation, because you cannot control what's their prejudice or bias opinion on the situation when you enter the situation or when you pick up the call. But then it gets into the what I call the mechanical delivery, thinking about your nonverbals, your body language, your tone, your rate of speech, and all that, and then the magical words, what you need to use. But when I do workshops, I really spend very little time on this is how you should look, and these are the words you should use. So that's a minor part of the stuff. More is on the mental preparation, on what am I and how am I going to deal with the situation? How do I respond to frustrations and whatever attitude that you have to encounter?
Mm. What advice do you have for people that maybe have a quick temper when it comes to certain topics? And there's some that, and some people are quick when they, as soon as they're threatened or as soon as they're disrespected, they fly off the handle. For other people, I mean, I've seen some very calm, otherwise professional. When I was working in mental health in particular, you obviously mental health nurses at the top of the food chain, when it comes to their ability to deflect and manage antisocial behavior. But I know that I saw one nurse who completely lost it physically when his children were threatened, but it was a prolonged buildup. So what advice do you have for people that know they have a trigger, that know they have something that is a real hot button for them to be able to manage that?
That's again, what a great question. I have no good actual study to back this up, so it's just 30 years in the field. I'm quite confident that about 20% of individuals in no matter what profession you work in are amazing. They're spectacular when it comes to dealing with people who are very, very emotional. That's 20%. That's pretty good. Every fifth person. About 75% of individuals, they'll do okay, but there might be a situation or they're not at their best just before lunch or at the end of the night shift, or there might be specific type of customers or suspects that they find trouble dealing with. And with these individuals, we focus on exactly the professionalism and your self-image. But there's 5%, and 5% in every single profession. So it's in the police, it's with aviation, it's with a public order, it's with restaurants, hotels. 5% of individuals are the ones that really get drawn into the conflict quite easily. And there's two things that I recommend is that if you recognize yourself as being that individual, do you understand that you are actually giving the control to the client instead of you? So if there's a specific word that I use and I get you, Joe, to get really angry, and every single time I say that, I see emotional reaction, then I'm in control. The client is in control. This is my game. This is my home field. And I'm going to win this situation. Now you are behaving exactly how that justifies my own behavior as a customer. But the other thing that I want to talk with organizations is that I think supervisors and organizations also need to be honest in thinking that perhaps this individual shouldn't be in this role. Because I don't believe that 100% of individuals can be trained to deal with, because we have people who are very emotional, very fragile with their emotions. We have people who have their own personal histories from domestic violence or school bullying or workplace bullying, or they changed jobs because they were beaten badly in the previous job, but they really haven't come to grips with their past. And the burden is still with them. And as soon as something similar happens, I'm back in that unpleasant fighter mode that really doesn't promote your professionalism. So if possible, if we have a team of 10 individuals in hospital emergency room, and we got one individual who's really skilled in everything else, except with family members or patients who are frustrated, then as a supervisor, as a team leader, I might want to try to make sure that this individual doesn't have to deal with them if that's the role.
Yeah, there's so much to be said there for the role of management as well, to not expose people to situations you know they're not equipped for or that they shouldn't be in. Look, I had one when I was working in healthcare where there was just a general medical ward, nothing particularly special about it, but there was only one male nurse in that pool of nurses in that ward, and he was incredibly flamboyantly gay. Like, he was the most effeminate, flamboyantly, cannot miss him under any circumstances, that like no one in the 1800s, everyone would have known he was gay, right? There's no way you can miss it. And he was not hiding it by any stretch. They had a patient who was massively homophobic, right? Older guy, did not like this nurse at all. And made many, many off-color remarks the first time he saw him, and basically just never let it go after that. And I was called in after this had all eventuated, and I'm looking through the data saying, okay, so the first time we went in to see him, you said, you know, called him this, this, and this. We've clearly established he's homophobic. He's got an issue with this particular nurse. And then like a couple of hours later, there's the same nurse going back in there again and again and again and again over 3 days until eventually he gets assaulted. And the question is not, okay, sure, the behavior is not acceptable, but at what point do we say it's not acceptable to keep exposing this nurse to the risk? And I asked that question. I said, why did you not swap him with anybody else? And the nurse manager said it was his call and he didn't want to let him win. He didn't, and that was, it all came down to a battle of egos that he felt he had a, and look, completely, like, he has every right to do his job, and on a point of order, sure, but is it worth the, you know, the punch in the face that he ended up getting and missing a week of work? And
well, I have a similar story, but with a very, very different ending. I was doing a workshop way up north in Finland to three psychiatric wards. And I got there with the morning plane, and we had lunch with the chief nurse before the training. And she was saying, oh, this is so wonderful, and we've been waiting for this training for so long, blah, blah, blah. And nobody else has the skill what our past, I mean, our psychiatric nurse called Alice used to do, but she's retired now. And I got really interested when she was saying about Alice. I said, well, tell me more. What's so special about Alice? I said, well, Alice was very, very short, or is very, very short. So she was about 150 centimeters. So she was very, very petite. And Alice had a reputation that whenever any ward had to put a patient into a straitjacket or isolation, and apparently patients don't like this too much, the call for help would be, send your two biggest male nurses or send Alice. and I said, that's wonderful. So what was the magic? Well, how did Alice manage to do this? And she said, we don't know. I mean, she just retired one day and we don't know. And this is the story I tell the people. I said, figure out who's your Alice. Who is the Alice in your team? And then benchmark that information. And take your most typical difficult situation, write it on a piece of paper, and then everybody in the team writes their own solutions to the situation. Because many organizations, they have that silent knowledge with one or two individuals, but nobody asks, how did you do that? How were you so successful? So my message is figure out, if you don't want to figure out who's the worst possible individual in dealing with conflicts, then look who's the best and benchmark that information.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so much to be said for being able to extract out the what they actually do, because chances are they never learned it as a technique. It was never written down. It's just something they've figured out. And it can be very hard for them to actually explain unless you have someone who's skilled at drawing out that information about what they do. it's what one of the things we're looking at the moment in with Risk to Solution is we're looking at doing some more research, another research project into verbal de-escalation techniques and into what actually works, because there's so little actual literature on what works in a social setting. There's a bit in a clinical setting, but not much in a social setting. Okay. And there's so many people out there like yourself, and there'd be thousands of others just like you all over the world that have strategies that work, but we just haven't put them into one sort of document that says, here's some stuff to try. Because unfortunately, by the time you have figured it out, you tend to retire.
Yeah. That seems to be the case all over the world, not just Australia, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you find that the attitude towards this is different between law enforcement, where, I mean, there's a culture of continual upskilling and mandatory training and mandatory courses and so on, versus the private sector, where at least here in Australia, and I think for most of the West, there's training that's put to the things that make money, like sales or contract management or even customer service, but it's to take people offline and teach them how to manage conflict or how to be safe or do self-defense or whatever it's going to be. How have you found that? Is that attitude shifting? Are there more companies that are interested in preparing their staff for this conflict?
I would say that in Northern Europe, it's quite the opposite. So law enforcement is, I mean, of course, Northern European police organizations are mainly civil servants. So they're not as law enforcement oriented as what we would see perhaps in North America. So I would say that the private sector is actually more leaning towards this type of training, because they see the financial value of solving conflicts or making sure that their staff feels that they have tools to deal with aggression or with highly emotional individuals. So it doesn't have to be aggression per se. So I'd say it's quite the opposite in law enforcement and private security. They lean more on, well, it's the law and law says, and you have to do this and that. And people don't challenge the police in at least in Finland too often. So, to give some perspective to this, for over the past almost 20 years, the National Police has been the most respected and trustworthy organization than any other organization in Finland. So people trust the police more than they trust the church, education, healthcare, any government organization. Wow. So I guess it's the training is quite extensive, and it is the police university, and it's 2.5 years of base. So the attitude of the police might be different, but people do respect the police more as well. So maybe that's the reason why police doesn't always see it as necessary to train these, because when I'm the police and I say, calm down, people calm down, even though really they're not calm, but at least they look
they moderate their behavior. Yeah. That is really interesting. I'm sure there's many, many jurisdictions out there that are now rapidly trying to figure out what Finland's doing. I know I've got law enforcement listeners from all over the world that are probably had their ears prick up at that idea that the police are actually trusted. So I could go on a tangent there, but I think we'll stay on topic. It's one thing you said there is value in preventing conflict, and it's something that I didn't realize applied across my life. So I learned conflict negotiation through necessity, bouncing at nightclubs, basically, and figuring out that, I worked for a good reputable company that made us do paperwork whenever we went hands-on with somebody. So because of that, the more people you could talk out, the less paperwork you had to do at the end of the shift, right? So it's good. It's a good incentive, even if you do like being physical. But it wasn't until after I became a parent that I realized that I was using some of the same strategies. And that actually, it made me look into the study even further, because I was like, well, controlling human behavior is all about controlling human behavior. Like, it doesn't matter what the context is. And listeners of the show know I've talked to other grapplers. I'm predominantly a judo guy, but I've wrestled, I've done sumo, I've done belt wrestling, I've done every form of traditional wrestling there is. And I've often said that wrestling is wrestling. It's like the skill set is to wrestle, and then there's just a whole bunch of games you play that where you just change the rules and the uniforms, and you have a different objective, but it's the same thing, right?
Yes.
And now I can actually apply the same thing to moderating human behavior, whether it's trying to get my 4-year-old to get out of the bathtub, or try to get someone to stop leaving abusive voicemails on someone's message bank.
Yeah, I fully agree with you, and I think the basic skills. Something that I noticed, I spent, as I said, almost 10 years as a negotiator. And those situations are very, very extreme. Usually you have suicidal individuals. So it's mainly on suicide intervention. It's not hostage negotiations or none of that. But the basic tools and the techniques that you use there, I could use on an accident scene where somebody had been waiting for the police and paramedics for an hour and a half, and you finally show up and they're very, very unhappy about it. But the same techniques as a supervisor, I was running a team of 30 officers, the same techniques, because there was always somebody who wasn't not happy because they didn't get their summer vacation in middle of July, or they didn't get into the motorcycle police training program, whatever, same techniques. And I got 4 kids, same techniques with my 25-year-old as with my 13-year-old. But I must say, kids learn quite quickly. So
yeah,
so it makes it more challenging.
Yeah, the kids pick up on the techniques much quicker. They got a more prolonged exposure.
Yeah,
yeah. No, it's quite fascinating. I think there's a bit of a revival now, just in terms of pop psychology, I guess, of what people are interested in. I think Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference, being a huge success. I think that will probably generate another sort of burst of interest. I think those of us that have been working in the field have always stayed connected with what's going on and who's doing what, but I'm hopeful that the mainstream success of negotiation books, and I think people look at negotiation now as something you can do to generate more sales. I was just talking to Robin Drake, who'll be the episode before yours. And Robin was the head of counterintelligence behavioral analysis for the FBI. So his role was essentially after 9/11, he was recruiting spies for the US government.
Okay, wow.
And but he's now built a corporate career in building trust and rapport. And again, universality of human behavior. If you can build enough trust that they're willing to betray their government in countries where that's not such a great idea. And I'm sure you can build trust in the corporate world as well. So tell us a little bit about what you do now. Like what's your business and what do you actually do?
Well, here in Northern Europe, we mainly work with customers. I'm not talking about my company's customers, but the communication situations with customers or patients or students. So it's the external conflict and how to prevent these through policies and training, and then actually case management strategies on this one. And then in Southeast Asia, we work with internal problematic behavior. So workplace bullying, sexual harassment, stalking, anger management, suicidal behavior. So it's quite interesting because I've lived in Hong Kong for 10 years now, and looking at the customer service in Southeast Asia, customer is always right. So you rarely get similar type of conflicts in Southeast Asia on an airline or hotel or insurance company or whatever than what you get in Northern Europe. In Northern Europe, it's more on communication skills and the ego issue. And in Southeast Asia, you don't get that, but you get internal problematic behavior. So large corporations and people not managing their social duties in a suitable way, so to say. So two different types of works.
That's really interesting. You're living a yin and yang between the two different cultures and
yeah.
Yeah, it's I have to say I'm quite fascinated that the approach of the Southeast Asian customer is always right mentality, whether that manifests itself in internal problems because the person doesn't feel they're able to express their own emotions.
I think you're right. And one of the things, when we teach organizations in Southeast Asia on customer service, we teach them assertiveness on how to set limits to the behavior. Because let's say you're an airplane with 250 passengers, and there's one individual who doesn't know how to behave. If that passenger is always right, you're going to have 249 passengers who are not happy. Mm. So there's nothing we can teach to Southeast Asian airlines on how to be a better customer service professional, but we can teach you how to set limits to the problem behavior so that the other customers feel that their needs were respected.
Mm. There's nothing worse than being on a plane with one person that you feel may get you grounded. I kind of want to see you get what's coming to you, but I also don't want to be grounded in the middle of nowhere while you get arrested.
I got so many war stories on this one. I've actually been involved in 13 situations on my flights where we've had unruly passengers. Yeah.
13.
But only twice any type of physical means were needed. So, but yeah, that's my point exactly. I'm more than happy to help you if we don't have to land in Kazakhstan and I'm going from Hong Kong to Helsinki.
I spent some time in Kazakhstan, and I remember the flight out of there. This is completely unrelated, so it may not even make it in the podcast. But I remember distinctly conflict management. Here we go. On the flight out of Kazakhstan, I was on flights that had been organized by the event organizers. So they'd just gone the cheapest possible flights, right? So I'm flying China Southern Airlines from Kazakhstan to. So I'm flying from Astana to Almaty to Beijing to Guangzhou back to Brisbane, right? Like 50 hours. It's ridiculous, yeah. It's 50 hours from the time I left my hotel to the time I got home. But I know there's one flight. We're in Almaty, and there's one flight from Almaty to Beijing like every 2 days. And there's only maybe 15 of us waiting for this flight. And the security guard in the airport has taken off his baton. He's got the side handle baton, the PR24. And he's put it through the handles of the doors that lead out to the runway, and then propped his stool against the door, sat down and gone to sleep against the doors, like in front of everybody. Like he's locked the doors with his baton and he's gone to sleep. And I didn't think much of it. I thought, I've seen a few things like that in Kazakhstan. And then, I'm starting to look at my watch and I'm like, we're supposed to be on that plane soon. And I'm looking at the other businessmen, the other people who are mostly Chinese businessmen, and we're all kind of looking at each other like, do we go and talk to him? Like, do someone need to wake him? Because I'm like, I'm going to be stuck in Kazakhstan for another 2 days if I miss this flight. And thankfully, he woke and let us on the plane. And as it turns out, it was a good thing too, because we were on that plane. It was a massive plane, and we had like every customer had like three rows to themselves. Like it was just massively empty. Yeah. And I said to the traveler, flight attendant, I said, why are you even running this service? And she said, oh, we need the plane back in Beijing. They needed the plane back. So, yeah. So if the guard had fallen asleep, that might've been a problem for them.
Wow.
Anyway, but yeah, sometimes that people will avoid having that conflict because you don't really know whether this is, is it my job? Do I have to say something?
Yeah. I've actually, because I used to work with Finnair for many, many years. So whenever I fly, I go to the chief purser or a customer service director or whatever the title is, and I give them my business card, an ABP, able body passenger, and my seat number on it. I say, I know you're good, but if you need somebody to sit on top of people, I'm really good at sitting on top of people. So come and wake me up. That's probably the reason why I've been involved in 13 different situations. Yeah,
you've been tagged.
I would rather still do it than land in a country where I was not supposed to be landing in.
No doubt. All right, Totti, we're going to start winding up the main part of the interview. Just for those that are leavies here, I know you're going to do the bonus content with us shortly, but for those that are leavies here, what are some of the big takeaways do you really wish everybody knew about how to manage conflict verbally?
Yes. Well, there's three basic rules that I recommend every professional or every individual to keep in mind when you have to deal with situations that are volatile or very, very aggressive. First one is listening beats talking. So if you really want to de-escalate someone's emotions, you need to listen. It's not about you talking, it's about you listening. Second one is emotions are more important than facts. So that's where the role of empathy comes in. So it is important for people to hear that their emotional reaction or their emotional status has been recognized or at least acknowledged. And the last one is it's better to come and start the de-escalation with solutions rather than problems. And this is one of the most typical problems that I see with professionals who really don't have the training is if somebody is demanding something from you and the only thing you can come up with is a negative response. I don't make the decision. It's not our unit that can do this. This is Friday already, so it's not going to happen. People don't calm down when they hear what they don't get. So whenever you give a negative response, I would love to hear a positive. For example, sir, I don't make these decisions, but the decision, what I can do at the moment is this. Sir or ma'am, this is not our unit that handles these, but what our unit in this situation can do is this. Or today's Friday, unfortunately, what you're asking is not possible during this week. But the things what we can still do during this day are this. So whenever you're saying something negative, please come up with a positive solution, what you can do in the situation. Those three would be the main takeaways.
Man, there's so much value there. The idea of just letting the person win, like just letting them feel like they got something. I mean, oftentimes I find like in customer service, especially when someone has got up and they've made a scene, like they have put an emotional investment in now. Like if they don't leave with something, even just the feeling like they save face or that they've achieved something, then they're going to be embarrassed and ashamed and it's probably going to escalate. So the ability just to literally I've seen things de-escalate over a free cup of coffee. It doesn't matter what it is. Just let them leave with something so they can save face and go, I got something out of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Excellent. All right, Totti, for those that may want to know more about you or they might want to engage you if they're in Europe or Southeast Asia, do you have a website that we can send people to?
Sure. Yeah. Peaceofmind.hk. And that's peace as in peace, not a piece of your mind. So peaceofmind.hk.
All right. Excellent. Okay, Totti, you're going to stick around and do the bonus questions with us for our Patreon subscribers. But for everyone else, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to doing it again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, guys. I hope you got a lot out of that conversation with Mr. Totti Cappella. By all means, make sure if you want to listen to more from Totti or from all our previous guests, head on over to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/managingviolence. And you can sign up there and you can get bonus content from this episode and every guest we've had for about the last 30-odd episodes. Amazing amount of extra content available there. Hours and hours of the best minds in self-defense and violence management, all available for as little as $5 a month. Make sure you check it out. Subscribe to us on your podcast provider of choice. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Go follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. We're everywhere. Check it out. Thanks very much for your support, guys. We'll be back next week. Cheers.